daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, President Xi Jinping inspects Hunan province. What key messages does the visit send out? China has launched a new relay satellite to provide Earth-Moon communication services. How does that pave the way for China's future lunar missions? And Netanyahu has renewed his pledge to attack Rafah despite Biden's warning. Is there a widening rift between Israel and the U.S. over the war in Gaza? Chinese President Xi Jinping has been on an inspection tour in the central province of Hunan. In the city of Chengde, he stressed the vital importance of food security in spring farming and called for protecting farmer interests. Earlier, the Chinese leader also visited the provincial capital Changsha, where he heard about local endeavors to accelerate the development of new quality productive forces and promote high standard opening up. For more, we are joined by Liu Zhiqin, Senior Fellow of Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University of China. What are the primary areas of focus during Xi Jinping's inspection in Hunan province, and what key messages does the visit send out?
I think this visit by President Xi Jinping to Hunan sent a very important message to the outside, especially to domestic market and also for global market. In three aspects, in my opinion. The first he stresses and outlines the importance of high-quality productive force, how to follow up and what the measures should be taken to ensure this implementation of the new quality productive force. And secondly, he emphasized the importance of the spring farming efforts, because at this moment, especially in this week or these 10 days, a crucial time for the rural areas. This farming job is very important for the bumper harvest for this year. So he stressed again the importance of the spring farming. And the third, of course, he stressed the importance of the high education and combined with rich culture and heritage in this province in order to have a better eco environment, in order to promote high quality development and also a wider opening up policy.
Yeah, so what role does Hunan province and the broader central and western region play in China's overall development strategy?
From geography, we can see Hunan province really is a very important place. It's in the center, in the joint point of the western central part of China. So Hunan in the history is a very important strategic spot for all nations and the countries in this area. And of course, it provides very important productivity in the past years. So especially the Hunan can be well connected with the middle and the central and also the western part of China, because Hunan has its own advanced technologies base and also has a very high qualified university. That's the talented people there are very rich resources. So all this can be really well managed and coordinated together to support the further development in the center, the central China, and also in the western part of China. This is a very important bridge to the west.
Well, as you said, Xi Jinping highlighted the need to accelerate the development of new quality productive forces. Can you elaborate on what the term exactly means and how local endeavors in Hunan province align with this objective?
Yeah, this is a very important task for the whole nation, not only for Hunan. Hunan has its very special functions to implement and further develop the quality productive force, because the new quality productive force embraces a huge, large numbers of industries, emerging industries, high technologies and science. And in my opinion, his visit also emphasizes not only with the science and technologies innovation, And for instance, the new energy industry and computerization, digitalization, or green technology, but also including the soft power. As I understand that the new quality productive force includes soft and hard science and technology from both sides. From the hard science and technology with the equipment, AI, or smarter technology with the manufacturing together. But the soft is including the cultural heritage, especially in Hunan province. The cultural heritage is also should be included and emphasized as a part of new quality productive force. Only by the combine these two parts, I think the new quality productive force can really make the greatest contribution to our modernization.
How do you see Hunan province contributing to China's efforts in achieving high standard opening up, particularly in light of geopolitical challenges and the changing global trade dynamics?
As we know that at this moment, the global market is very in different turbulence, and especially European countries are in chaos of conflicts with each other. So in this way that how China, including Hunan, contributed to the vital opening up, how to give more contribution to develop the economy locally and globally. I think in Hunan, its function is quite important because Hunan has its own character and has its own features, has its own advantage, especially from the Hunan has 2 points that the advanced technology, research and development. As I know that Hunan's research and development investment last year ranked fifth in the whole country and occupied or reached 1.1 trillion yuan. This is really a big contribution of Hunan to the world globally, especially when Hunan is opened up. That means that all the other rest of the country that has no other reason that not to open up widely to the Western investors. So in this way, that we should have more policy supportive and to give more boosters that to invite more foreign investments in this area.
Yeah, and Xi Jinping also visited a university campus during his stay in Changsha, the capital city of Hunan. How does that reflect China's efforts in talent cultivation and human capital development?
That's a very important question. We know that Hunan is very rich in education and cultural heritage as before. 100 years before, we know many Chinese scholars and Chinese scientists came from the Hunan. They became famous and made great contribution to the modern China, especially for modernization in China. So in this way that he paid a visit to the local university and contacted the students and teachers there, and also emphasized the importance of the revolutionary heritage. That means to combine this modern technology with the party's history together to make this more education is more effective, and we can have more qualified that the young generation to continue to fulfill our tasks, because our mission is to have China's modernization. We should rely on our generation. This is the basic point that President Xi Jinping visited the university there.
Yeah, and Xi Jinping's visit to a village in Hunan province emphasized the importance of rural revitalization and agricultural modernization. So how do you foresee Hunan province balancing traditional agricultural practices with modern technologies to ensure sustainable rural development and also food security?
Actually, Hunan is set a good example to the rest of the country because Hunan has really a good combination of tradition and modernization. If we want to see Hunan in the villages in the countryside, we see many traditional and historical scenes, and we can feel very deep-rooted the atmosphere there. And also they have also the most advanced technologies and education. So in this way that we can see that Hunan will make more contribution, especially from the rooted area, because the grassroots have always more motivation that for modernization. They have indolence that efforts to have to try to get a better life or high quality of life. So that's why that this area is, as we know, is famous from hardworking and very intelligent. So in this way that we can see Hunan people and Hunan culture and the economic will make greatest contribution in the near future.
Yeah, and the inspection also focused on various aspects of grassroots governance, including the reduction of bureaucratic burdens and improving governance efficiency. How do you look at China's efforts in this regard?
I think China has met many uncertainty and challenges. In order to solve this uncertainty and challenge, I think from the governance, especially from the rooted level, governance is quite important. How to make more efficiency, how to make that the people really closely related. As we know that the people have many concerns about their life, about their economic development, how to solve all these problems. So all these administrations should try to have closed connections to know, to feel, to contact the root people that what they are thinking, what they need. No more bureaucratic. The bureaucratic always reflected that they have too many meetings, they have always conferences, they have always oral promises, but less put in the reality. This is what the people that hope that to be avoided. So this bureaucratic should be avoided as soon as possible in order to get the topmost instruction from the central government can be immediately that implemented at the root level. This is very important for our future modernization.
Liu Zhiqin, Senior Fellow of Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University of China. This is World Today. Stay with us. This is World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. An Australian scholar says the most distinctive feature of China's whole process people's democracy is that the leadership of the Communist Party of China and the democratic system reinforce each other in the development process. Professor Roland Bohr from Renmin University of China made this remark at the Third International Forum on Democracy that has commenced in Beijing. The event has sparked discussions on how China's whole process people's democracy has enhanced democratic efficacy, emerging as a trending topic. During an interview with my colleague Xu Yawen, Bohr also notes that the stronger and more established the democratic system and processes are, the stronger the leadership of the CPC, and vice versa. And there is no socialist democracy without the leadership of the party.
How do you perceive Chinese socialism and also the socialist democracy with Chinese characteristics? In other words, whole process people's democracy.
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation and opportunity to have a discussion on this particular topic again. I think the phrase or description whole process people's democracy is actually a very good one. Because it explains more about the type of democracy that is developing and is established in China. Because when you say, you know, especially talking internationally, socialist democracy, you think, what's that? How does that relate to democracy, people say? But when you say whole process people's democracy, then you're talking about what it literally says, a whole process. So, you know, the two main components, if you like, and they're in a dialectical relationship with each other. One aspect is electoral democracy, and elections are held right through for the many levels of the People's Congresses, the five levels, first two levels direct, and then the next three levels indirect, right up to the National People's Congress. But then you've also got this comprehensive process of consultation. That's the other side of it, which is integral to the whole system. It's not extra to the system, it's integral to the whole system. And this goes way back before the founding of the new China. It's already in the period leading up to the establishment of the new China that these practices were developed, whether it's with mass organizations, grassroots activities, grassroots governance, and so on. And it's not as though you've got separate sides. They interact all the way through, all the way through. And of course, the People's Political Consultative Conferences are the institutional manifestation of the consultative process. So you've got all of that. That's what when you say whole process people's democracy, that's what you're talking about. Everything is around, is part of the process.
So from electoral, consultative, grassroots, to leadership of the CPC and rule of law.
That's
so
right.
Each segment together make the whole process.
Exactly. And yes, no, and very good to mention the leadership, the CPC, and also rule of law. The terminology for that is statutory processes that the will or decisions of the CPC and the will of the people manifested through electoral consultative democracy have to go through a whole series of statutory processes before they're actually a decision is made about them and they're owned in the democratic process itself. And that's absolutely crucial, that sort of mediation process. And that's what the whole system does. It mediates. It provides the mechanisms for connections between the will or decisions of the CPC and the will of the people.
For Westerners, this one is very tough to understand, the role of the Communist Party of China in socialist democracy. Mm-hmm. And you once said socialist democracy is enhanced by the leadership of the party, and the leadership of the party is enhanced through socialist democracy. Could you elaborate more on these ideas?
Well, if I may make a small push for a book I had published earlier last year, it's actually on the history and theory of socialist governance, where I sort of studied this material right through from Marx and Engels up into practices in China today. And what happened noticeably a little bit over 100 years ago after the Russian Revolution was it became clear that for developing a socialist form of governance and a socialist democracy, that the Communist Party had to be in a leadership position. How do you understand that? For Westerners especially, that sounds like a contradiction. It's either one or the other, but you actually have them relating to one another throughout the history as it developed. The term used for it is democratic centralism, but it's democratic centralism which is applied to governing the whole country and not just the CPC or a Communist Party. And the democratic centralism, the principles of that as it's developed through practice and theory, is that without a robust democratic practice, you don't have a strong central element. And without a strengthened central element, you don't have robust democratic practices. So that's the way the contradiction works. It's not either or, it's both and. And so the more established, more developed the democratic system is, the democratic processes are, the stronger is the leadership of the CPC. And vice versa. They strengthen one another in the process of development. And this has been proven historically that's how it's developed. And to my mind, that is one of the most distinctive features about whole process people's democracy or socialist democracy. It's that relationship. It's absolutely crucial. People have to understand it. And without that relationship, you don't have socialist democracy.
Well, for many Westerners, it's hard to understand because for them, elections means democracy.
That's right.
But under the context of Chinese socialist democracy, it's a combination of election and also substantive democracy. So how do you understand, how can we better explain that concept to people who are confused about this part?
Well, one of the, as you point out very correctly, people in Western countries at least have become used to the idea that democracy just means elections. And, you know, you might have an election every 3 or 4 or 5 years, And then by and large, people don't have a say in anything. And then that passes. But that's become fixed in people's heads. And so another part of understanding the process, as you're saying, is the need to realize that elections are only one part of a substantive democratic process, which draws on the will of the people and provides feedback and decisions to the people all the time, whether it's developing legislation, whether it's dealing with local grassroots issues, whether it's pursuing, the big questions. It's something, when it's substantive, it takes place all the time, not just through rare days of elections and so on, and then that's it.
Well, back to the Chinese whole process, people's democracy, how does the advancement of this whole process, people's democracy, play a role in furthering the modernization of governance?
The two go hand in hand, it seems to me. And one thing that always impresses me about the situation in China is, no matter how good something is, it can always be improved. You don't sit back and say, oh, look, it's been achieved. No, the process of improving the governance structures is an ongoing process. Strengthening adherence to the constitution, ensuring that rule of law and the legal system keep being updated, educating people about the process for participation in it. So all of these aspects, and modernization of the governance structure, improvement of the governance structure, this is an ongoing process, not just that times change, but that things can always be improved.
Another thing I want to ask you, this is a very interesting question I saw online. So one netizen asked, is it possible for China to become a democracy like America? When I firstly saw the question, there were two things pop up into my mind. First, why should China become a democracy like America? And secondly, why is American-style democracy the best option? So what's your response to this kind of question?
Well, now most people in the world will probably answer that. Nobody wants to be like American-style democracy. Look at it today. It's a mess. It's a complete mess. But that's another aspect we can look at in a moment, actually. The approach I take to this is that the political structures, government, democratic system, arises and is appropriate to the economic foundation in a country and its history and its culture. So when you got, say, American-style democracy or, Western-style democracy, capitalist democracy, that grew over time as capitalist economic systems were growing in those countries. And in light of their own particular histories and cultural traditions, that particular political structure, for a time anyway, seemed to be an appropriate one there. But when you've got, and there's many different examples, but take a Chinese situation with its own history, its own cultural tradition, and the establishment of the new China in a socialist system, and the economic system, which is quite distinct from all of that, call it what we will, socialist market economy, new type of planned economy, then you can't take a political system that grew up somewhere else and just put it on top of a different foundation. It's not going to work. It has to be a system that arises from the context. And so that's where it's simply not going to happen. And if at some point, well, it's been tried in former colonized countries, such as Africa and elsewhere, and it doesn't work very well.
So there is no one-size-fits-all political system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's correct. You have to take into account, like I said, the history, culture, context, foundation, all those things. Yeah.
That is Professor Roland Bohr from Renmin University of China speaking with Xu Yaowen. You're listening to World Today. We'll be back after a short break. This is World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. China has launched a new relay satellite to provide Earth-Moon communication services. This marks a key step for the country's future lunar exploration missions, such as retrieving samples from the far side of the moon and exploring the lunar South Pole region. The satellite, dubbed Qiuqiao-2, has entered a planned orbit. Officials say the satellite needs to undergo a series of important maneuvers before it enters its target elliptical orbit around the moon to become the world's second relay satellite deployed beyond Earth orbit. For more, we are joined by Zhang Fan, Associate Professor of Astronomy Department of Beijing Normal University. Professor Zhang, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
So how significant is the launch of this new relay satellite, and how will it support China's upcoming moon missions?
Right. So the most immediate reason for launching this satellite is because China, later this year, China will launch Chang'e 6, which will go to the back of the moon and scoop up some dirt samples and dust samples and return it back to Earth. But the backside of the moon doesn't have a direct line of sight to Earth because the moon is in between. So you need something in space to be able to see both Earth and this probe. To be able to relay the information. So this is the most direct reason. But in terms of a longer term moon missions, Qiuqiao-2 will, together with Chang'e 7 and 8, the two later on missions, to form the basic configuration of China's International Lunar Research Station, which is why this Qiuqiao-2 not only covers the backside of the moon. It can also provide telecommunication capability coverage for the South Pole, which is roughly the region where China's research station will be in the future.
Yeah, and talking about the far side of the moon, it has a permanently blocked view from the Earth. So why is establishing and maintaining communication with this region of the moon so important for scientific exploration and future lunar missions?
It is interesting. The backside is interesting in itself. There is something called tidal locking. So the moon always has one side facing Earth. We can't see the other side. But after we were able to go around and take a picture, we found out that it actually looks quite different from the near side. In the near side, there are large black regions, which is basically frozen sort of volcanic lava. But you don't have those on the backside, which means the geology on the near side is much younger. There has been volcanic activities lasting later in the lunar history, but it's a different story on the backside. The volcanoes died a lot earlier on. So one explanation for that is the compositional, the chemistry being different on this both sides, possibly because the moon was formed by Earth colliding with something, so different parts of these two different colliding bodies contribute differently to the near side and back side. So Chang'e 6 going to the back side and scooping up actual samples and to be analyzed and compared with the near side samples, it is quite important in terms of understanding the history and geology of the moon itself. And also there is the issue that on the back side of the moon, you have this moon shielding you from any sort of human-made noises from Earth. So if you build astronomy instruments on the back, look into deep universe, then you avoid all the noises, human-made noises. So that'll be quite important as well in the future.
Okay, so what are the key technological advancements incorporated into Qiuqiao-2 compared to its predecessor, the Qiuqiao, which was launched back in 2018?
There's a whole bunch of incremental improvements. It's basically becoming smarter, becoming more adaptive. You know, it can tune its frequencies to ensure smooth communications between the moon and Earth. But those are more incremental. The biggest change is actually, so this launch, it doesn't carry just Qiuqiao-2. There are two additional Pathfinder satellites going to the moon together with Qiuqiao-2. So those two are to test out the technology for future constellation around the moon, which can provide navigation capabilities like how GPS or SATO work on Earth. They would also be able to provide communication capabilities, so it will be a global network of telecommunication satellites around the moon rather than Earth. and also some remote sensing capabilities. So essentially, those are the really revolutionary parts of this mission.
Yeah, and we know that Chuchao-2 also carries payloads such as an extreme ultraviolet camera and an array neutral atom imager. So what scientific objectives does it aim to achieve beyond its primary role as a communication relay satellite?
Right. Because there's some payload, extra payload capabilities available, so the Chinese Academy of Sciences, specifically its Space Science Center, has been able to squeeze some telescopes for astronomy onto this mission. The extreme ultraviolet camera is there because this kind of wavelength is blocked on Earth. Even if you go into low Earth orbit, it would still be blocked. So you need to go far enough, and this mission is good for that. And also the other instruments like the atom imager stuff, they can look at the Earth's magnetosphere. It's the Earth's magnetic field in this configuration and stuff. Because that thing extends quite far out, so you need to sort of go far enough away to be able to have a full picture. So that's that. And then also quite interestingly, there is a very long baseline sort of radio astronomy thing, a test going on there. So essentially, you combine with radio telescopes on Earth to form an extremely sensitive, sort of high-resolution composite radio telescope that will be able to see really fine structures in its target celestial bodies. So those are small instruments, but they're all quite ingenious in design.
Yeah, and by the way, given the 8-year mission lifetime of Chuchao-2, how does China plan to optimize its capabilities to facilitate not only China's own lunar missions, but also potentially those of other countries?
Right. So the most immediate thing is once you have a lunar research station, you mm-hmm. really need to be able to not only talk to Earth quite well, but also to be able to move around on the moon. For example, if you put a rover on the moon and that thing can move kilometers or tens of kilometers scales, then the curvature of the moon begins to show up and block a direct line of sight between your rover and your base station. And then you need a satellite in the lunar orbit to be able to act just like a communication satellite on Earth to be able to relay information between those two, both on the moon as well. So that's the most immediate thing. And the later thing is, as I said, this constellation that will really move all the space infrastructure around Earth that we enjoy and rely on every day, put them around the moon. So you can essentially do all the important things that we do on Earth, but move it all to the moon. So you can build up your research station. You can put your scientific instruments everywhere, and they'll be able to relay data back to Earth and know where they are, what time they're taking data from. So that infrastructure is fundamentally important.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Zhang Fan, Associate Professor of Astronomy Department of Beijing Normal University. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has insisted that ground troops will enter Rafah. In an address to a parliamentary committee, Netanyahu acknowledged U.S. President Joe Biden's opposition to such a move, but he said there was no other way for Israel to achieve its goal of destroying Hamas. This comes a day after U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said a major ground operation in Rafah would be a mistake. For more, we are joined by Dr. Guy Burton, adjunct professor at Department of International Affairs at Versailles College in Brussels. Dr. Burton, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
So Netanyahu says there's no other way for Israel to achieve its goal of destroying Hamas without a ground offensive into Rafah. How do you look at this assessment?
Well, I think it's Netanyahu has a problem because it's a very maximalist approach that he and the Israeli government are taking, which is to eliminate Hamas from Gaza, to remove the regime and to eliminate the armed wing. I mean, even if he was successful in doing that, I think he's got a problem because, you know, the ideas behind Hamas aren't going to go away, you know, sort of political Islam as well as sort of the armed struggle. These remain, quite highly supported in parts of the Palestinian population.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So do you mean that even if Hamas is eliminated, that's not going to resolve the longstanding issue between Israel and Palestine? And maybe that will lead to more Palestinian people joining similar groups?
I mean, that's a possibility. I mean, if you take out Hamas, the organization, I mean, you'll probably find that a new organization is going to emerge which has those sentiments. And I think it's also worth noting as well that about a month or so after the war started, so we're looking at around November, you know, the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research was polling Palestinian society about its reaction and response to the war. And what was noticeable that even though there's a majority of Palestinians who don't support Hamas, they were sympathetic to Hamas's struggle. So, you know, there's a big issue there that, you know, the ideas aren't going to go away. So, you know, yes, you might be able to remove the actual organization on the ground, but, the ideas remain.
Yeah, and actually those remarks made by Netanyahu comes a day after a phone call with Biden, who reiterated that he is against an offensive into Rafah. So how does that reflect the growing tensions between the U.S. and Israel over the course of the war? And do you think that's going to affect the U.S. support for Israel?
Well, I don't think it's going to affect, we're not going to see the Americans abandon the Israelis. I mean, they've made that, you know, they remain, you know, strong supporters and backers of Israel. But I think, you know, maybe Biden's strategy has been shown to be, weak and not very successful. I mean, his idea was to very much hug the Israelis close. In the wake of October 7th, when, you know, the Israelis quite rightly, you know, had, anger about the attacks that had taken place. I think maybe Biden's thinking was that by keeping the Israelis close, you know, emphasizing, you know, American-Israeli sympathy and solidarity, that they might be able to influence the Israelis quietly and encourage them to, you know, move, you know, to start thinking about what happens afterwards. What we've kind of seen is that this hasn't really happened, and we're not just seeing it over the Rafah offensive. We're also seeing it over humanitarian aid. You know, the Israelis wanting to limit and restrict severely what can go into the territory, and the Americans opposed to that, as well as basically what happens afterwards. I mean, a lot of what Biden's been focusing on is, you know, the day after, what is going to be the solution there? And there, the Israelis and the Americans are quite wide apart.
Yeah, and Netanyahu said Israel was engaged in a dual campaign, one military and one diplomatic. But given the ongoing dispute with the Biden administration, is Israel actually losing ground on the diplomatic front?
Yes, and I think that's probably the case for at least two reasons. So one is what Netanyahu wants. I mean, if you look at what the Americans have been talking about, they want the Palestinian Authority, which is based in Ramallah in the West Bank, to come in and take over once Hamas is removed from Gaza. Netanyahu does not want that. He wants to maintain Israeli control over Gaza even after the war ends, and wants to separate Gaza from the West Bank. So already there's a split there. And also that's a position really that, you know, Netanyahu's position is not accepted by the wider international community, which wants a Palestinian state, which really the Americans are also echoing there. And I think also, so that's a problem for the number one. The second problem, of course, that Netanyahu faces is the disproportionate action that Israel has undertaken. I mean, we're talking about, you know, yes, on October 7th, surprise Hamas attacks killed over 1,200 Israelis and took 250 people hostage. But since then, we've had 6 months in which 31,000 people have died in Gaza, of which a third are children. We've had 85% of the population displaced. We've got now 1.4 million people, you know, out of the 2.3 million based in Rafah, which is what we're talking about at the moment, most of them living in tents. So it's a very disproportionate, and I think in that sense, you know, Netanyahu's lost the public relations game.
Well, how would you assess the role of the U.S. in influencing Israel's position? And do you think it's playing a constructive or obstructive force in helping finding a solution to the conflict?
Well, I think the Americans would like to, I mean, if you ask them, they would say that they're playing a constructive role, that they're trying to focus their efforts on what happens, you know, after the fighting ends. I mean, the big problem, of course, is that, you know, the American ideas and plans are sort of predicated on the Palestinian Authority taking over Gaza, as I previously mentioned. The problem is that the Palestinian Authority has very little influence in Gaza currently, you know, and the Fatah faction, which runs it, is at a very low credibility, very low legitimacy in the West Bank already. So what are the Americans going to do to actually boost Fatah and the Palestinian Authority's influence and legitimacy? The problem is, even if the Palestinian Authority went into Gaza, you know, the day after the fighting, they are going to be hampered by their relationship with the Americans. They're going to be seen as their proxies. So it's very difficult, and really there's very little outside-the-box thinking in terms of what the Americans might do beyond talking about the Palestinians.
Yeah, and you know, Israel has agreed to send a delegation to the U.S. to discuss their offensive in Rafah and perhaps hear suggestions from the U.S. So do you think the Biden administration is going to offer an alternative plan?
Well, I don't think it's Biden himself is proposing that the Americans put forward a plan. I mean, what they want to see is that there is a plan for dealing with, the civilians that are trapped in Rafah, that any kind of military operation that the Israelis undertake is not going to target or, adversely affect the civilians, that they're going to be protected. But so they want to see that there's going to be an evacuation, there's going to be resources available for that, there's going to be a time frame for that to happen. And as far as they're saying, this isn't happening. The Israelis, on the other hand, claim that they are doing this, that the IDF does have a plan to move Palestinian civilians in Gaza to supposedly safe zones in the center of the territory. And this is going to be done with support from the international community. But so far, I don't believe there's been any sort of enthusiasm for that.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Guy Burton, adjunct professor at Department of International Affairs at Vassilis College in Brussels. Thanks for joining us. This is World Today. We'll be back. You're listening to World Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Apple is in talks with Google for a potential deal to integrate Google's Gemini AI tool into the iPhone. According to Bloomberg, the two tech giants are in active negotiations for Gemini to power certain new features for iPhone software due later this year. Apple CEO Tim Cook said during the company's annual shareholder meeting in February that the company is investing significantly in AI. Bloomberg is also reporting that Microsoft has been talking to Apple about the use of ChatGPT. For more on this, our Zhao Yang spoke with Andy Mok, tech analyst and senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization.
So, Andy, if the tie-up between Google and Apple comes to be, how would you expect it will benefit the two companies?
Well, I think that's a very good question, Zhao Yang. I think first, if I may, I'd like to offer a little bit of context about this. So clearly, there is tremendous interest in AI, and there's a lot of money flowing into AI, especially some of these so-called Magnificent Seven technology companies, NVIDIA, Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet/Google. And one of the criticisms that Apple has come under is that it appears to be lagging behind. And so we could easily interpret this as Apple looking to catch up by partnering with Google to somehow use its AI capabilities, Gemini, or maybe some other AI capabilities that they have. But I actually think that this view perhaps is mistaken, and that Apple, in fact, may be the dark horse in AI and may end up being one of the big winners. And the reason for this is that whether we're looking at Gemini, whether we're looking at ChatGPT, these are all applications that run on hardware devices, whether that's an Apple iPhone, a Huawei phone, a laptop computer. But what Apple brings to the table that is, I think, an enormously powerful strategic advantage is that they own the entire technology stack. from the hardware to the operating system to the application layer on which Gemini and OpenAI, et cetera, run. And what this means is that when they integrate, and it's not if, but when they integrate AI, it will most likely be not at the application layer to compete with these other AI applications, but at the OS level or the operating system level. Now, what this means is that their AI will be faster, it'll be more secure, and more importantly, it can do more because it can access potentially everything that's on your smartphone and even every source of data you have contact with. Because if you're at the operating system layer, you have, from a technological perspective, a security protocol perspective, you can access much more data, and this could be enormously more powerful than anything we see on the market today.
Mm. And Bloomberg is also reporting that Microsoft have been, you know, talking to Apple as well about the ChatGPT in there. We don't know whether it finally will be ChatGPT or Gemini or others, but how would you expect a major AI partnership with Apple to shake up the AI industry?
Well, exactly right, Zhaoyang. I think that Apple here may very well be the dark horse, meaning the horse that no one expects to win that will actually end up winning the race, because it is exactly Microsoft with its partnership with OpenAI, Google, that has attracted a lot of attention. And in Google's cases, I think attention for all the wrong reasons, because of a lot of the problems that have been discovered with Gemini and Bard before that. So I think how it could shake it up is that it may be Apple that delivers the truly breakthrough transformative AI applications by integrating information from your calendar, from your email messages, from all the different apps you use, including Gemini and ChatGPT. But here I have to say, too, we're talking about Apple today, but we should also put Huawei in the same bucket as well, because I think it also owns the entire technology stack. It, of course, produces smartphones, tablets, computers. It also has its own operating system, Harmony. And, of course, it has platforms and app stores and its own apps as well. But moreover, I would say Huawei is even broader because it is also in automobiles and other types of devices. So these are the companies, I think, that many people are overlooking and underestimating.
We've seen rapid development of the big language AI models recently. So what does this new leap in AI mean for different industries?
Well, you know, we see a lot of attention paid to LLMs, large language models, and it's captured the imagination of consumers and the media with these chat bot interfaces. But I think we have to recognize there are many other kinds of artificial intelligence that are very important. Image recognition, where China has been the leader. Even if we look at apps like TikTok and Douyin, you know, these were considered true AI-powered apps that could be very powerful recommendation engines. We look at diffusion models that are powering Sora. And I think the importance here is not that you can turn text into video, but this shows that AI is learning how to operate in the real world, because it can effectively model real world effects. If you push on something, what will happen? That this means that it's developing what I would call animal artificial intelligence, not human intelligence, but animal, meaning it can move like a leopard, like a monkey, like a bird in the real world. And this will be tremendous, tremendously powerful.
And NVIDIA just announced a new generation of AI chips and software for running AI models this week. So how advanced is this new generation of AI chips, and how important is it for training and deploying large AI models?
Well, you know, I think, yes, it is very important. So one of the new chips they announced is called Blackwell, and I believe it is 30 times as powerful as their previous architecture. But I think, and it can handle, I forget the number, was it like 17 trillion parameters? So I think more processing power is always good. But at the same time, I think we should not overestimate the importance of raw processing power. We've also seen in the field research that you can get very good results with fewer parameters as well. So it's an exciting time. I think that this bodes well for NVIDIA as a company and NVIDIA's share price as well. And this may, at least to a degree, reassure some of the doubters that think that NVIDIA's stock price has advanced too far too quickly. But certainly, I think this is very, very important and an important piece of this AI revolution that we're living through.
And a lot of advancement and development in the AI sector, and it also triggered regulatory issues as well. And European lawmakers have passed the first major law to regulate AI in the world, the EU AI Act. So, Andy, what terms and clauses have impressed you most from this act?
Well, I think, it's important, of course, that the EU is a major market, an important stakeholder in artificial intelligence. But to a degree, I think it is also somewhat symbolic that they're first. We have to look at not just market size, but also the technology leaders. And I think here the U.S. and China, have clear leadership in this area. But at the same time, I think it's useful that the EU has advanced this risk-based framework. And I think the AI technology revolution and the application of it is certainly breaking new ground. And regulation is even more so, in that regulation usually is in reaction to new developments. So I think it's early days for regulation. Certainly, it's a step in the right direction, but we also have to see how much coordination and cooperation we see globally with these issues as well.
That's Andy Mok, tech analyst and senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization, speaking with my colleague Zhao Yang. And that's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. I'm Zhao Yang. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.